Hello and welcome to a special audio-only edition of the Scar Thoughts podcast. My name is Jackson Bevins. I'm a writer over at fieldgoals.com, and with me today is my editor and Seahawks writer par excellence, Danny Kelly. Danny, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Jackson. Thanks for having me on the show.
Of course, man, always. Those of you listening, this is sort of an impromptu cast. We definitely wanted to get our thoughts on free agency and how the offseason is progressing now that we're officially into the 2016 NFL league year. We will be doing a full-blown offseason podcast with all the boys at the bar coming up, but it was really important to me to get Danny on and let you guys hear his thoughts on how free agency is progressing. And Danny, let's jump right. But the Seahawks have retained some fairly big players, at least players that are big to us Seahawks fans, maybe not major needle movers nationwide. But you want to give us just a quick rundown of where the Seahawks are at in terms of players they've kept around and kind of your thoughts on each?
Yeah, so the big ones are obviously Atiba Rubin got re-signed as a defensive tackle. Jermaine Kearse is a receiver, and then Jeremy Lane as a cornerback. So those are the kind of the three, like, I think the most important ones. And then there are some RFA tenders that are important as well. But I mean, those kind of were already expected. So those
don't forget my boy, John Ryan.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Punter John Ryan. Actually, that's a big one too. I mean, those are the kind of things where continuity and consistency are important. I think, like, you don't have to make any major changes with your special teams now. I mean, other than there's going to be some new guys playing special teams, but you know, you got a very accomplished and veteran holder in John Ryan. And he also, you know, is maybe not the greatest season of his career last year for the Seahawks, but he's a very experienced guy at punter, and kind of, you know, he's got an accurate leg and kind of can do what the Seahawks want to do with their punting game. Cause they're not necessarily, you know, they're not a team that likes to, like, necessarily try and boom punts. They more try and pin you where they want you to be and play it safer. So I think he kind of fits what they want to do in a lot of that. And so I think getting John Ryan back was a big deal. But to me, the biggest one was probably Jeremy Lane. And it looks like his deal is pretty good, pretty team friendly. You know, he's the kind of guy that can play outside. He can play inside. He's probably going to end up being the nickel corner, which is the inside corner. A lot of teams that, pretty much every team now, their base offense is three wide receiver set. So you're going to have to face off against teams that have three good receivers a lot of the time. So having someone that can defend in the inside is really important. I think they saw the importance of that. He's been in their system forever, so he knows it. I think that's a big deal. And, you know, there's not going to be any kind of, like, Kerry Williams style situation where they're kind of trying to teach a guy their system and integrate him into the Legion of Boom, even though, you know, cause you've heard Pete Carroll talk about this a lot of times. It's like, he really brings people in and indoctrinates them into their system. So it takes a while. So I think that's a big deal with Lane. And it's actually kind of similar with Kearse too. You know, I don't think the Seahawks offense is one that you necessarily can learn quickly. I think there's a lot of option routes, and it's kind of unique in the sense that Russell Wilson scrambles so much. So there's a lot to learn with getting on the same page with the scramble drill and all that. So getting a guy who's made a lot of big touchdowns for them over the years, you know, he's not necessarily a big volume guy. And I think people kind of complain because he disappears every once in a while, but I think he's kind of a solid addition. It means that the Seahawks don't have to like evolve or anything going into next year. It's just kind of like, you know, consistency there. So I think those are all three solid signings. And then obviously John Ryan's the fourth, like, a good signing. And I actually didn't talk about Rubin yet. I think it's, again, just another good signing. He's young. Pete Carroll said he's the best three tech that he's had in his system. So that's a huge compliment. So I think, yeah, getting him, he could probably play nose tackle if they want him to. I don't know what's going on with, you know, losing Mebane, but I think that was another just under the radar, low key, but good signing.
Yeah, Rubin is one that I'm really excited about. I am trying to remember if there are any other interior linemen that Pete Carroll gushed about as much as he did Rubin last year. I mean, it seemed like every chance he got to mention the job that he did, you know, Pete Carroll took it. And it's a very, very good run-stuffing team against this year. And I think that that's what Rubin's main ability is. Yeah. I thought that was big, especially with Mebane losing or leaving, I guess, and with, you know, the Jesse Williams experiment is now finally over. Jordan Hill has been really good, I think, when he's been healthy. But again, health is the key. And while I think Seattle is really deep on the edges of their defensive line, I was really, really happy to see who I thought their best interior defensive player was last year stick around.
Yeah, and I think it's I mean, if you look at the Seahawks run defense numbers from this year, it was really, really good. I think they were third in yards per carry given up, and then they were first in yards per game. So, I mean, that's like the main – that's a huge deal for Pete Carroll. Everyone kind of talks about the Legion of Boom and stuff, but stopping the run first is like his number one priority. Mm-hmm. And then that makes you a one-dimensional team. If you can take away the run from another team, then they have to beat you through the air. And that's what Pete Carroll's off – or defense is kind of designed around, you know. So, you know, getting turnovers, get the ball, don't let anything over your head kind of thing. And so it's a big deal. It's a huge deal to them to be a good run defense team. And I think getting a guy in there that proved he can, you know, play – like what Pete Carroll said, they played a lot of over fronts last year. And so Atiba Rubin is sitting right there on the strong side between the guard and the tackle, which is where a lot of runs are aimed. You know, so he's at the point of attack, literally, in a lot of offensive runs. Like the majority, I think, of offensive runs go towards the tight end side. Right. So he's kind of in the meat of it. And so I think they really liked what he did for them there. And, you know, he's youngish and he's been healthy and he's versatile. So I think all those things kind of, you know, made it a good signing. And I don't think it didn't cost him very much because, you know, run stuffing defensive tackle is not necessarily the most expensive position group in the world. And so getting him in there for a relatively cheap deal is good.
Yeah. I think that interior line, kind of like, you know, strong safety or middle linebacker, you can really find some market inefficiencies at those positions simply because, you know, you got to pay so much more for a corner or a free safety or an edge rusher than you do for some of these guys, that you can get really top level talent for essentially mid level price with those situations. And to your point about how important stopping the run is to a Pete Carroll defense, I think it's similar to what you and I were talking about. we went out for drinks the other night about when you're a basketball player and your shot is falling, how it changes what your opponent has to do against you, right? Once they have to respect that shot, it opens everything else up. You can kind of do whatever you want. And I think the same thing, if you can take away that run, I mean, if the opposing team is able to run on you, they have their full playbook, you know, it's like them shot and they're able to do everything else. And if you can take that run away, then you're passing into the teeth of the defense and they know it's coming. So I think there's a lot of value there. And along those lines, for those listening, and if anyone cares, Danny and I played some 3-on-3 basketball yesterday.
What's that?
Oh, I just said you whooped me yesterday, man.
Danny, I wouldn't go that far. I thought it was pretty much ugly basketball on all accounts.
Yeah, big difference between being in shape and being in basketball shape.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about Jeremy Lane, and he, like you, he was the number one guy that I was hoping Seattle would retain. You know, I kind of made my peace with Irvin moving on. And I figured Lane would as well. You know, I thought Sweezy would probably go. I think Okung will probably go. But, you know, that was a big one for me. And I think this is what you're talking about. You know, you really need five defensive backs now. Like, that fifth defensive back isn't a sub anymore. That's a starter. They're on the field for 60%+ of the plays, in a lot of games. And having a guy with the versatility to cover inside and out, I mean, those are really two different positions. There's a reason why a lot of top corners don't move into the slot, even if their best receiver does. It's a different world in the middle of the field. So having a guy like Jeremy Lane who knows how to stay assignment correct, kind of in that whirlwind that happens between the hashes, I think is a really, really valuable thing. And he's not afraid to tackle either, which I think is a really underrated aspect of playing that nickel corner, because you are going to be asked to make those open field tackles a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's a mentality thing. I think you had a funny anecdote about your first time at Seahawks training camp. I mean, that's kind of just, you know, indicative. He's kind of like the, he's a scrapper.
Yeah, exactly. So for those of you who didn't see, I tweeted this out right after Jeremy Lane signed, but the first time I ever went to a Seahawks training camp, Jeremy Lane had just been drafted. It was one of his very first practices. And there was a scrimmage. They were scrimmaging each other, which is really cool to be at. And Golden Tate was blocking him on a play and kind of blocked him through the whistle. You know, veteran doing it to a rookie kind of thing you see all the time. Except for Jeremy Lin didn't try and disengage. He picked Golden Tate up and body slammed him. And big fight broke out. Everyone, you know, people are piling on, yanking each other off, yelling. You know, people are barking. You can hear them from up on the burn, the side of the VMAC. And Pete Carroll kicked Jeremy Lin out of practice. This is, again, one of his first practices. And I remember it was so interesting because Richard Sherman excused himself from practice and walked Jeremy Lin all the way into the VMAC. And if you've been there, you know, it's maybe – really, they were about middle of the field. So it was maybe 80, 90 yards to walk back in. And I bet you that walk took 15 minutes. They went so slow and stopped every few steps. And Richard Sherman, you could tell, was just like coaching them up. And I remember thinking that – that was either the best or worst thing that he could have done for this team. And
right.
I think it just showed more than anything that he wasn't afraid. You know, Golden Tate was an established member of the team. He was a high draft pick, was starting to come into his own. And, you know, we all know that he's a top, all that stuff. And so to see him not back down on that, I think probably went a long way. And I'm glad it worked out and that the team sees enough value in him to keep him around. And I'm also kind of glad that, you know, as horrible as that injury was and as much as
right.
Super Bowl 49, it probably kept him affordable.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, actually. I think him playing a very limited season last year probably kept his price down in terms of them, you know, re-signing him. I'm actually going to see, what did Casey Hayward end up making? Did you see this at all? Comparable player in some respects.
Yep.
He got a 3-year deal. Worth $15 million, 6.8 guaranteed. So let's see. I forget what Jeremy Lin got. But I think it's somewhere like – it's something comparable.
Yeah, wasn't it 4 for 13 or 3 for 13?
Oh, yeah. Hold on. Okay, I'm pulling it up. It's a 4-year 23. So he basically got – this guy got 3. What's that?
Yeah, right. 23, not 13, obviously.
But his is 4. So, I mean – they're comparable. What,
is that 11 guaranteed on that? If I remember.
Let's see here. 4-year 23. I don't know what it said, where it says it.
Yeah.
I should memorize these.
Full guarantees with so $5 million signing bonus, base salary, take it up to $7 million guaranteed plus another 4. So potential $11 million in guarantees. Yeah, you know, with the price of cornerbacks on the free agent market the last couple of years, and after I saw what Janoris Jenkins, who I don't think is great, got this year, I pretty much wrote Jeremy Lin off as gone when that happened. So I was very, very pleased to see they kept him around.
Yeah, I think teams probably see him more as like an inside guy, but I think that's kind of similar to what happened to Hayward. He can play outside, but I think people – probably see him more as like a slot corner.
Do you see in Seattle's second outside corner?
Well, it will probably be Shed as the default. And then there's a couple of guys that could challenge him, I think, and you know, potentially take his spot on the outside, I should say. Ty Smith is one guy. He's kind of intriguing. You have to kind of see what happens with him. I think Mohamed Cisse and Stanley John Baptiste are kind of guys to watch. I think they could potentially be kind of surprising next year in eventually winning that spot. But I'm guessing if you at the start, it'll be Deshaun Shedd kind of as the de facto starter, and it's his job to lose.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how that kind of shakes down because, like you mentioned before, the Seahawks' way of playing corner, especially on the outside, with that kit. I mean, it is a complete rewiring of how you've been taught to do it your whole life. And, you know, Deshaun Shedd still talks about how that's the number one thing that he works on in practice is getting that kick step right. And he's been with the team for, what, 4 years now?
Right. Yeah. And actually, I forgot about Thurald Simon, too.
Going to ask you your thoughts on Thurald Simon.
Yeah. I mean, he's another guy, if health did – I mean, he's kind of like Jordan Hill a little bit in that I think he could be good, but you can't – I can't really call him good because he's always hurt. So I think, you know, Theroux, he has a chance to kind of come in there and win that job if he can stay healthy or if he can even get healthy. I think his foot's been screwed up for a long time. And then he had shoulder surgery last year. And so he's just been kind of all over the place. So I think he's another guy that could potentially end up winning a starting job outside. So there's like three or four guys really that are, I think, going to be battling for that job. And then on the inside, I think Lane is probably the favorite for the nickel. And then Marcus Burley and Ty Smith might kind of compete for that as well.
Sure.
So it's going to be good. Yeah. It's a good competition there. I think there's some good talent. They are going to have the issue of a lack of experience there, but it was good that Shed got some experience, you know, on the outside this season with, you know, the
experiment. I thought he did okay.
Yeah, the Kerry Williams experiment failure was good in the sense that it got Shed some experience on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, and isn't Deshaun Shed the guy that said, you know, if Russell Wilson said if you're picking teams for a pickup football game, Deshaun Shed would be his first overall pick on the team.
Did he say that?
Yeah, something to that effect. So apparently the athleticism isn't the issue. It's just kind of technique and instinct that if he can get that, he might have themselves a good one.
Yeah, and I'd like to take credit for my amazing analysis because I actually liked – I said multiple times when they had Shed at safety that I liked him more as a corner. Like early on in his career, he just doesn't look, he didn't look very good to me as a safety. But he looked like real solid as a corner. So I don't know. I think I'm pretty smart in that pretty regard. Good. Yeah. Patting myself on the back on that one.
That's pretty good. yeah. I think the other one that I kind of assumed was gone, especially after the Schefter report a week ago, was Jermaine Kearse. And that was the one I was probably the most okay with.
Right.
Just because I see Jermaine Kearse as kind of a I think that his skill set is replaceable, right? Mm-hmm. He's not exceptionally anything. And I wouldn't even say that a lot of times guys who aren't exceptional at any specific thing is they can at least be consistent, right? And, and you don't really see that with Jermaine Kearse. He kind of pops his head in and out of the box scores week to week. But I do think this past year was his best year. And I think that with the sort of goofy ad lib approach that Seattle's passing game ends up taking, having a guy who has, you know, 3 years, 4 years of running around with Russell Wilson on the field is really valuable, you know, and I hope that he isn't our red line deep threat moving forward. I think that he kind of got shoehorned into a role that doesn't really suit him in the past, but I do like him as the guy that can get you 12 yards when you need 11 yards. And I think that he started to show that towards the end. In fact, his last game against the Panthers was exceptional. Didn't he finish with like 110 yards and a couple of touchdowns?
Yeah, and one of them was a jump ball kind of back shoulder thing too. I mean, like I think people would definitely kind of concentrate on some of the things that frustrate you about him, but he has made quite a few big plays for the Seahawks. The play that I remember, I think my memory, hopefully my memory is correct on this, but he had a huge third down catch against the Vikings.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember this. I forget what route exactly it was, but it was kind of like a comeback and he caught it like just all hands, like extended away from the body. And then he was tackled really hard. He held onto it. And it was like an enormous third down in that game, late in the game, and kind of helped them, you know, keep moving. Although technically the kick, obviously the missed field goal was like the biggest play of that. But, at that point in time, it was a huge play. So, I don't know.
We talked about that on this podcast that week. I mean, you're exactly right. It was against the Vikings. And if you watch the replay, I mean, everyone remembers how cold it was and how hard it was to catch a football that has no tackiness to it.
Yeah.
Hard as a rock. Your fingers are losing their feeling. And this, 10 maybe. And it was, a comeback route. And Jermaine Kearse, who has always been a frustrating body catcher, reached out and like stuck it at full arm's length and kept the ball in his hands away from the defender the whole time. And I mean, it was such an unreal play that that one made me stand up and kind of take notice is like, all right, you know, he may be turning a corner. And shoot, I didn't think Doug Baldwin was all that until the last half of this year. I thought he was good for what he offered, but I didn't think that he was great. He became great last year. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason to think that Jermaine Kearse can't take a similar type of leap. I mean, he was the second most efficient receiver last year behind Doug Baldwin in the entire NFL in terms of when the ball was thrown to him.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the way that they're looking at it is like with the trajectory of Russell Wilson, with the way he played in the second half last year, like, you know, they can make him into a player that earns that contract. Cause it felt a little high when you kind of see the 4.5 APY or whatever. But at the same time, I mean, that's really kind of not high when it comes to receivers. There's tons of like, I mean, I think there were 22 receivers that had 1,000 yards receiving last year. So there's tons of receivers out there. And a lot of them make a really good money. So I think, you know, they're paying him as kind of like a mid-level receiver. And I think that's kind of what he is, but he could potentially be better.
Yeah, right. I mean, and you know, you're paying he's kind of in my mind, he's the de jure number two receiver, but kind of the de facto number three receiver with the emergence of Tyler Lockett. Mm-hmm. But when you think about paying your second or third receiver $4.5 million, that ain't so bad, you know? Right. And I think that continuity does matter. We'll never be able to quantify it. And some guys just have the ability to step in and be productive. But we've seen how much trouble Seattle has had in bringing in receivers. Even their really good ones that they've drafted or picked up as UDFAs. And Doug Baldwin, you know, it took them a while. It took them a few years to really get there. And then, of course, the Percy Harvin thing never worked out. And, you know, Tyler Lockett's the exception. It only took him a few games to really become a real weapon on offense. But it's hard to just go out and get someone that's going to be better than Jermaine Kearse. It takes a while at the NFL level. So right. I think that when you consider that Russell Wilson finished the regular season on the hottest seven-game stretch, arguably in the history of quarterbacking, having all of his wide receivers back next year isn't such a bad thing.
No, I totally that's exactly how I look at it. You know, trying to keep that continuity and chemistry together so they can, you know, hit the ground running next year. Because if you don't have Kearse, you're like, say you're one injury of Doug Baldwin away for Lockett's your number one, and then there's this weird random grouping of. Hopefully, you know, Paul Richardson's not hurt. Kevin Smith, Jeff Fuller, Kason Williams, Deshaun Fox, Anton Goodley. It's a bunch of randos. And then Lockett's gone. You know, he's not going to play this year, probably. So it's just a bunch of randos.
For everyone who's freaking out when they heard Danny say that, he's not talking.
Ricardo, yeah. Ricardo Lockett with the neck injury.
I always say that because that freaked me out at first.
No, sorry. Yeah. No, then Tyler Lockett becomes your number one, and he's not really definitely really, really good, but, you know, I don't know. So I think it makes a lot of sense from the depth point of view, also just from the fact that you're playing a lot of three wide receiver sets. You're going to have to pay your second and third guy money. You know, I mean, if you look at some of the top passing teams, most of them have at least two really good receivers. A lot of them have three. So, I mean, I think it just made sense to keep him. I don't think it was a bad deal. I think it was kind of just like, it was an okay deal, I would say.
How much, in your opinion, do the losses of Mebane, Sweezy, and Irvin affect this team?
I was never really too high on Sweezy. I think he had his good points, and, you know, they were exciting at times. Like, he'll, like, lay a guy out or pancake a guy a couple times a game, and that has value, but like, he was very inconsistent, you know, falls off blocks, can't like, you know, he would get beat one-on-one a lot in pass pro, like just immediately.
One pass pro,
what's that, say it again?
You just can't get beat up the middle in pass pro,
right? But I mean, especially, you know, I mean, if you look at some of the throws that Russell Wilson made in the second half, like, hey, having a pocket, it's really fucking good. You know what I mean? So it wasn't disappointing even remotely for me that J.R. Sweezy left in free agency. He got like 7 APY for the first couple of years. So it's like the Seahawks probably weren't going to pay that. I'd rather have, you know, I don't think there's probably going to be a big drop off between him and Mark Golinski. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of, maybe it's biased, but I was just not very high on Sweezy. I just didn't think he really, I think his development plateaued about year two. And he's kind of been the same guy since. And with the way that, you know, they've got some young guys coming in that I don't think it would be a huge drop off for them to play. You know, actually, that's not saying a lot because the Seahawks offensive line has been awful until the second half of this year. But I think to me, that wasn't like a big, big loss. I just, you know, it is what it is kind of thing. But Mebane, I think, you know, in terms of positions that you can probably replace, nose tackles maybe one of the easier ones. I think just because, especially if you're talking about like a run stopping nose tackle, there's quite a few guys out there that can do that. It's a good draft for that too. So I think they probably saw that. And if you look at the deal that Mebane got, it's like basically a 1 year deal. I mean, de facto, I think they can cut him after 1 year and like lose nothing. So, the Seahawks obviously didn't place a high value on re-signing him. So that kind of, I mean, that kind of tells you what they think of replacing him in that spot. You know, obviously it's kind of a bummer because he's such a consistently fun player to watch and consistent, like Seahawks. He was at, you know, for a few minutes, the longest tenured Seahawk.
Right.
So, you know, obviously that's kind of a bummer, but I think in terms of finding a run stuffing nose tackle, that's something they can do, especially, and I have a lot of faith in them to do it because of some of the guys they've brought in over the years to kind of just man spots on the defensive line. Kevin Williams, Tony McDaniel, you know, these kinds of guys, Alan Branch going back even further, come in and kind of just play that role. Not that necessarily the nose tackle role, but play a role on the defensive line. And I think that they can probably replace him relatively easy, or at least easier than a lot of other positions. So they probably looked at that as it was a, if they could get him back, it'd be like a bonus or a luxury, but they weren't going to like, you know, go away from their plan to try and keep him.
Right. Do you think now that it's been 4 years and now that he's moved on to the Raiders, Bruce Irvin, first round draft pick, drew a lot of ire. In fact, that whole 2012 draft class did, between that and some linebacker no one had heard of from Utah State named Bobby Wagner and tiny little quarterback named Russell Wilson. I think Bob Condotta just posted that 2012 draft class is now signed contracts worth $250 million.
That's crazy.
Amazing. And you can see some of the guys from late in that draft who have gone on to get paid really well also. It's a pretty amazing thing to see. But do you think that Bruce Irvin's performance in Seattle justified a first-round pick now that it's all done?
It was, the 15th pick or something like that? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's borderline. It's borderline. I think because when you get in the first round, ideally you want like a Pro Bowler, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the goal. A multiple year Pro Bowler. And then like more realistically or acceptable is a multi-year starter, right? And I think he was obviously a multi-year starter. They could have kept him and it would have been defensible to kind of keep him at whatever price, you know, he got. But I think as a pass rusher, he was disappointing, you know,
sure.
But as a starter slash important player in their defense, I think you can't be necessarily super disappointed that you got a 4 year starter, or I don't know if he started 4 years, but you got a multiple year starter out of him. A guy who, you know, played tons and tons of snaps the last couple of years, last 3 years, and it would have been defensible to re-sign him. You know what I mean? It's not like he sucked. It's not like he was a bust. I don't think he was like a huge hit necessarily. If he would have, you know, he never eclipsed the 10 sack thing. I think his most sacks came as a rookie. So I think as a pure pass rusher, which is kind of what they, I think, thought they could turn him into, he didn't really pan out, but he did become a really solid Sam linebacker slash nickel pass rusher. And overall, I don't think it was like a big miss, but I don't think it was a huge hit either.
Yeah, you know, personality wise and just kind of overall, I don't know, dog ways type of
mentality. Yeah,
that Bruce Irvin had, you know, he's, you know, you and I talked about on the, on this podcast before, with Brent and Matt, if you were to decide football games, old Greek war style, and you send out your champion against the other person's champion, winner take all, Bruce might be the guy you send out there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to miss that a great deal, but I'm going to miss Bruce mostly for sentimental reasons. I think, yeah, the silver and black suits him really, really well. I hope he does great down there. He's definitely going to be one of those former Seahawks like Golden Tate that I follow and cheer just for personal reasons. But when you consider that you've got an all-pro level middle linebacker, and then right next to him is KJ Wright, who is Pro Bowl quality, and you're paying three-fourths of your secondary big money.
Right.
It's, and half of your defensive line big money. It's hard to justify $8-9 million, $10 million a year, mm-hmm, for a third linebacker. So I think that he is more kind of cap casualty. As far as justifying first round pick, if you had told me, you know, back then, hey, these are what his final stats are going to be when he leaves in 4 years, I'd probably say, yeah, I wish we would pick someone else. But I think that that also kind of understates, A, you know, his versatility and his ability to kind of morph into a few different roles. And B, they didn't, you know, that offense wasn't looking for their cornerstone linebacker. That offense had the – or defense, sorry, had the luxury of being able to take a shot on a guy like Bruce Irvin because they were so talented in other places. So I hope that he does really well, but I think that that's a position. That third linebacker, I mean, they don't even run three linebackers all that often. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's okay to save some money there.
Yeah, I mean, you said it earlier. It's like 60% of the snaps, I think, right now are nickel. So Irvin as a Sam is only playing – you know, 40% of the snaps or whatever, and then switches over to nickel pass rusher where he wasn't a top tier pass rusher.
Right.
So, I mean, I think the Raiders think they can turn him into something as a 3-4 backer or whatever. And I think that's pretty exciting to think about.
Kind of cool that his, you know, his defensive coordinator is his old position coach.
Yeah. I mean, obviously they have a lot of information on him, and so that says a lot, but, I think, you know, we talked to Doug Farrar the other day, Kenny and I did, and Doug kind of brought up the points, like, he's been in the league for 4 years and he still doesn't really have like any other pass rush move than a speed rush on the outside. You know, he does have like a little bit of a bull rush where he converts speed to power and kind of just like bowls into a guy with like his near arm. But other than that, he doesn't have very many counters. He doesn't have like a good spin move. He doesn't have like a club move. He doesn't have any of these moves that a lot of these top pass rushers have. And so it's like part of it is he kind of switched positions, so that stunted his development, but it's like you've been in the league for 4 years and he still doesn't really have more than one move. So there's still kind of like, is he going to develop that and become a great pass rusher, or is he kind of already peaked in terms of pass rushing? I think they're obviously betting that he can learn. It's just kind of interesting that he hasn't really, you know, developed that. I think what the Seahawks think they're going to do obviously now is you just get a Sam linebacker that can stop the run on base downs and, you know, set the edge or whatever. And that's important. And then find a guy who can rush the pass on nickel. You know? So you don't need to pay for like a three tool guy, like, or whatever it is, like with Irvin, you can just pay two guys that can do individual jobs and do them well.
Totally. Bruce Irvin kind of reminds me of like a Pedro Serrano style hitter in baseball where it's like, you know, light tower power on a fastball, but you throw a curveball and he's done with, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of one of those things where he, when it comes to pass rushing, I think you're right, he is kind of a one-trick pony. It's a hell of a trick, but mm-hmm, if you kind of anticipate it, then you've got a shot. My thought with the free agents that the Seahawks have lost is I would have been fine with bringing them all back, happy even to varying degrees, but not for the money that they signed with. You know, like if it took Seattle paying over $7 million for Sweezy, I would have been upset. If it took, you know, technically it's 3 years, $21 million in San Diego for Brandon Mebane, I think. But I think after 1 year, it's kind of, I think it's like 1 year, $7 million, really, as far as, you know, the team's obligation. I don't know that I'd want to pay Brandon Mebane more than that. You know, Irvin, we've already discussed, it's, I would love to have him back, but not at that price. So I personally think overall that they are handling their in-house free agents really, really well based on what the market is bearing out.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it kind of will be interesting. I think still the big thing is to find out what happens with Okung. But
you think Okung's coming back?
I don't know, man. I don't know. It like looks
no precedent for his free agent experience.
Yeah. It's like him representing himself, obviously, is kind of a big wild card. And he's kind of done his little tour. And sounds like he's gotten offers from everybody, but he's still, you know, feeling out, I guess, what whoever's, you know, trying to leverage those other teams' interests so he can get a better deal. Like I said at the beginning, I think he is really behooved to do this, like do it this way, where he's like going around and getting tons of it, like, you know, the bell of the ball type thing. Because I think other players are looking to him as kind of like the first guy that's going out there and representing himself. He has a big responsibility to make sure he gets the best offer, not just take, oh, you know, I want to stay in Seattle, this sounds like a great offer, like I'll take it. He's like, you know, I think he's feeling a lot of pressure to go and get as many offers as he can and blah, blah, blah. Like, so it looks good. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Well, and he's fashioned himself as such, you know, he's done some social media posts where he's really saying, you know, I'm going to try and change things for the players and try and bring the NFL Players Association essentially into a new era. You know, he's talking about giving leverage back to the players and not just doing what their agents say. And so if go and, you know, visit the Lions and sign a deal right away, then that I think might undermine that. So I got to think that there is some self-induced social pressure, like you're talking about, for him to go out and sort of win free agency for himself.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like he has to, his deal is going to have to look really good too. You know,
and it's interesting because what's so tough about it for him is he's coming off of a shoulder injury suffered in the last game that he played.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really a difficult thing, I think, for teams to look at. It's not like he injured it back in September and he's, you know, 8 months into his rehab. It's tough. That happened in January. And now it's March and he's trying to sell himself. I actually saw a tweet from Joel Corey. I know you're familiar with him, Danny. He's a works for CBS, former agent, I believe, and a real good follow for contract breakdown. He said he wouldn't be surprised if he sees something like 1 year, $5 million for Okung.
That would be, I feel like that would be a huge failure.
That would be a massive loss on his
bond. So, I mean, that would be really interesting if that happens. But it'd be surprising to me if it did, just because, I don't know. It seems like he wants something to be like, he wants something to look good. I think the basic bottom line is it needs to look good. And doing like a 1 year deal would probably not look very good for what he's trying to accomplish, you know?
So I'm going to throw some numbers at you. Would you re-sign Russell Okung if it took 3 years, $20 million?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so you're kind of right, but that's you probably wouldn't go much higher. I'm just trying to get.
I would probably go up to like 9 or something like that a year, okay. 9 or 10.
Yeah,
9. I don't know. That's what he's been making pretty much. Right. I think.
Right, and it's so hard, you know. You and I were kind of talking before we got on the air that it's really difficult for me anyway, to judge how good an offensive line does. I think to an offensive lineman, just because there's so much that goes into it. I don't pretend to know, you know, outside of the obvious like clear outs or if he gets beat, you know, the obvious successes and failures. But I feel like Russell Okung holds more value to the Seahawks than he might to other teams, simply because he has, you know, there's so little experience along the rest of them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know how, like, I'm the same as you. Like, I didn't play offensive line, so I don't know exactly how it goes. But I imagine, like, I like to picture things in basketball terms where imagine you're like, you know, there's five players on a basketball team on the court at the same time, and there's five players on the offensive line. Imagine losing your best, most experienced player and like what that does for
totally.
The attitude and mentality. It's like, oh shit. Okay. We're going to have to figure out how to do this now. Whereas like when he's in, it's like, you're like post up your center, you know, like this is your top scoring center. Say that. Cause that's your left tackle, right? It's your top scoring 6'10" guy who grabs 15 boards a game, you know? And then you lose him and you're like, well, fuck, now what are we going to do? Like now we have to figure out like how to make this work, you know? And so I think that's kind of like how I look at it just from a mentality point of view. Obviously there's no similarities in basketball to football in that sense, but just like from a mentality point of view, as you're getting all these new guys together and young guys, and you're losing your best player at the most important position.
Yeah. And it's for that reason that I'd like to see Okung back. It's funny because he's gotten this reputation as, well, he's brittle and injury prone and all of these things. And you've heard me rant on this before. I think that if you play in the NFL, you are officially injury prone. You're signing up for a whole bunch of car accidents every Sunday.
Right.
So I don't really buy that, but didn't he start 55 games in college? Like, I think that there's right. a handful of players in the history of college football with more starts than Russell Okung. And
yeah,
so
that's why it was like kind of crazy when he kept getting hurt his rookie year.
Yeah, right. He was coming out as the most like dependable offensive lineman in the last
year. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I still think that when he's good, he's good. And I think that his value to the Seahawks is a lot higher than it is to other teams simply because of the experience. And he would be the only, potentially the only opening day starter from last year coming back. Well, was Gilliam the opening day starter last year?
I think so. Okay. I can't remember. That's tough.
Either way, the point stands that it's a woefully unseasoned offensive line. So any experience that you can have, I think, is really valuable. So I'd like to see him back. But along those same lines, their Seahawks have been rumored to be interested in what are probably the top two remaining tackles out there in Beachum. I think it's Kelvin Beachum and Donald Penn.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on those two guys? And does re-signing Russell Okung preclude them signing one of those two guys? Or is there a shot that they can get a couple of them?
No, I think it would be one of the three. You know, just based on the money thing. And I think these guys all probably could get left tackle money, though. I don't know for sure. But yeah, I mean, I think if they can't sign Okung, I think, you know, probably honestly, the reason these three guys are taking so long to sign is because of Okung.
Yeah.
You know, they were kind of just waiting on him at this point. You know, I think I'm guessing teams are saying, okay, well, we're interested in you, Kelvin. We're interested in you, Donald. But we need to see what happens with the market, blah, blah, blah. And so as soon as Russell Okung signs wherever, it's going to be a domino effect. Cause then there's going to be like a secondary, like push for those guys, I bet. And so, cause I'm guessing Okung, Beachum and Penn have gone to most of the same teams, right? I think it's like the Steelers and the Lions and, the Seahawks and a couple other teams are all showing interest.
Yeah. It's
in the
sort
same
of a
guy.
Smaller circuit at this point, I think, right. for that position.
Right. So I think at this point, probably Okung is the top free agent and then it would probably be Beachum. And then, cause he's coming off an ACL. So his injury is probably more serious than Okung's, but I mean, he's younger. So there's other things like going on there, but, or he might not be younger. I don't really know. How old is Okung? But,
well, yeah, he was Pete Carroll's first draft pick. So he might, and he's 4-year starter. So do the math, maybe 28, 27.
Yeah, he's 28. So I think Beachum is like 26 or 27. So he's not that much younger. So I think Okung is kind of the top guy at this point. He's kind of, you know, feeling out his offers like we talked about, trying to get the biggest deal possible, making it look like he's working these teams and doing a really good job and like, you know, blah. So once that happens, those other dominoes will fall. If the Seahawks don't get Okung, I bet they'll get Penn.
Yeah, it would be a shame if they end up don't get any of the three.
Right. I don't know what they'll do if that's the case, because my backup plan was Alvin Bailey, who they showed like zero interest in re-signing.
Yeah, they must have been real unhappy with him, because I actually thought he was pretty good.
Yeah, there's something going on there. Like they don't like his attitude or his work ethic or something, because he wasn't, I don't think he was as bad as basically for them to refuse paying him like $1.6 million, you know, or whatever. So, yeah, it's, that was pretty interesting. I mean, he did obviously tweet that thing last year about like wanting to be in 31 other cities. So there's obviously something going on in the background. Like Cable right. doesn't like him. The other coaches don't like him. Something happened with like disciplinary or something. There's got to be something going on in the background. They, obviously, they're making fun of him for being fat for like the first couple of years. It's just like, I think there's just not good feelings between those. I think he wanted out, and I think the Seahawks were like, okay, fine, go. So, but yeah, I honestly don't know what they'll do if Okung doesn't sign and they don't get these other guys. So if Okung doesn't sign, I think they'll go for Penn. If Penn doesn't work out, they'll go for Beachum, kind of try and like, I don't know, because his injury is interesting, and I don't know for sure if he'll even be ready for the beginning of the year, which is, I think, holding up his market, obviously. So it's going to be really interesting. I don't think they have a left tackle on the roster right now, so they might have to look in the draft. Obviously, starting a left tackle as a rookie is kind of scary to think about. I'm guessing they'll try and sign one of these guys.
Let's say they miss out on all three. Would you trade your first rounder for Joe Thomas?
First rounder, man, that's tough. Well, how old is Joe Thomas? He's pretty old.
he's been all pro 8 times.
So stop trading their first rounder. What's that?
I said he's been all pro 8 times, which is insane. So he's been at least that long.
He's 31. So that's no spring chicken in NFL years.
Yeah.
Man, trading your first rounder for a 31-year-old, that seems kind of dumb, but again,
but if you miss out on all the other guys, would you do it?
I don't know. I guess I probably wouldn't, but like I could probably figure out a way to rationalize it because you do need to protect Russell Wilson. It's extremely important to give him a pocket.
I for as good as the Seahawks are and for my undying and unwavering faith that they'll be the best team in the NFL every November and December for as long as they have Russell Wilson and that defense, it's still frustrating as hell to spend September and October watching complete garbage on offense. Like I really hope that doesn't happen again with the offensive line, but I almost don't see a way where it doesn't.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they talked about how it took them way longer than they thought to like get everything together. It's like, okay, so this is going to be worse next year. Like, is that what you're telling us? Like, come on. Like,
cause then at the end, they were basically like, yeah, we weren't happy with how it turned out. So
no they're shit.
Like totally fine with turning it all over.
Yeah. And then I know, and I was at the combine when John Schneider was talking about, I can't remember the word. I keep forgetting what word he uses. Continuity or chemistry or something is the most important thing for offensive line. And here we are losing J.R. Sweezy, potentially losing Okung. It's like, okay, so how are you going to get that if you don't re-sign anyone? You know, because J.R. Sweezy is a 3-year starter and you just lost him. You know, he started the last like what, like 40 something games or I don't know what it is, but it's like, okay. So if that's the most important thing, what are you going to do about that? So I don't know. And then they signed Bradley Sowell or however you say it. So that's really exciting signing. He's played since 2013.
Breaking news. You heard it here first. The Seahawks have just signed former Cardinals injured reserve placeholder Bradley Sowell.
I was trying to fill
Seattle's gaps on the IR this year.
Yeah, I was trying to like read up on this guy, and like even the Cardinals SB Nation vlog Revenge of the Birds was like, yeah, this guy sucks.
you mentioned Doug Farr earlier, and he was tweeting out that Bradley Sowell might be the least accomplished offensive lineman in the NFL.
I mean, I'm not even kidding. When I heard that they were the Seahawks, the two offensive linemen that they were interested in first were Bradley Sowell and Ted Larson. I was like, Jesus Christ. Like two of the, like, probably like if I would have like made up a joke about like the worst two offensive linemen they could go after, it'd probably be those two guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Right. I mean, absolutely. It sounds like they're filling positions for interns in the accounting office or something.
Yeah, I don't know. My gosh. It's, so anyway, he could surprise people, but I don't think he's the answer.
Right.
He's kind of like, he's to me, he's Eric Winston. Like, he's like a guy like to play in training camp. And if he doesn't, if the rookies don't beat him, then they'll be forced to stay with him. But they're hoping the rookies beat him out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. So he kind of represents a low ceiling, and you hope that the players come along to push that higher. So I'm guessing then that going into the draft, Seattle's main focus is going to be on offensive linemen. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I think at this point, unless they get Okung back, they absolutely need you. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So you kind of take that statement that you and I both agree on and try and match it up with Tom Cable's personality. And if you guys don't follow at BVM on Twitter, you absolutely should. It's at _BVM. He's great. He has a great line about Tom Cable. It says, you can give Tom Cable a bunch of replacement level D-line converts and he'll turn them into a league average offensive line. You can give Tom Cable a bunch of first round talent and he'll turn them into a league average offensive line. And so it's like, I have no idea what to make of how good or not good Tom Cable is. The offensive line is bad every year. He kind of has built-in excuses because of the projects and whatnot. But he is outspoken about not really wanting a lot of highly rated college picks because he has to teach them how to block all over again in order to do it in his system. Do you see that as a problem philosophically moving forward?
I mean, at this point, it's like a lot of people have talked about, it's not just Cable, a lot of teams have talked about how the college game is not preparing offensive linemen for the pro game. Mm-hmm. And I think there's conspiracy at this point. I think that, you know, there's enough people saying it across different teams, across, you know, it's like multiple people that are highly respected are saying it. So it's not like some like excuse for the Seahawks, right? That said, I still think there is value in having guys that have played the position a lot before. You know what I mean? It's not like you can just get some athlete. I don't think you can just get some athlete and be like, here, we're going to teach you how to play. Like, you have to have the guys that have, like you said, you're getting in car crashes a lot, like, every game. Like, you have to have guys that have been out there and, like, know how to sustain a block. Yeah. That said, you know, some of these offensive systems, you don't actually have to do that. So it's a little give and take. So I think there is truth to what Cable and a lot of other coaches have said, but I think there's also some validity to getting guys that have played the position longer because there's just an experience factor. Like, you're going out there and you've played in a game before at that position, you know, even if you're not doing the same style of techniques, like just knowing the intricacies of spacing or, you know, how it all works, you know? I think there's value there. So I think it's kind of like a little bit of both. And, I just don't think the whole idea of like going out and getting the best athlete and turning him into an offensive line is like a viable thing for everywhere. I think it's good, like secondary, like market inefficiency is to like find guys like in the late rounds. That's fine. But, I don't think that means, oh, we shouldn't spend a high pick on an offensive lineman because the college game is not preparing them. I don't think that's true.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. What works at the college level, incredibly wide splits that you will never see in the NFL, and so I think that there's a lot of validity to that. So let's say that your assumption and my assumption is correct, and that they will sign one of the three between Okung, Penn, and Beecham. Can you rank for me the top four, putting you on the spot here, the top four position groups that Seattle will target in the draft?
Sorry, what say are, that.
What's the priority?
If they sign? Or...
Yeah, assuming they sign one of those three.
Then I want to rank the top four, huh? I would say, man, that's tough. I would still probably say tackle because, I mean, just depth. Really? What's that?
You think they move Gilliam or?
I just think you get, I mean, it's just like start preparing for the future. You could move him into guard at first, you know, kind of thing. There's just so much need on the offensive line for depth and for talent. I think that offensive line remains a huge need. And then from there, I'd probably go pass rush. I still think, you know, getting a guy that can rush the passer is huge. From there, I would go, man, this is kind of the nice part about the Seahawks roster is they have a lot, like they don't have like a lot of huge holes. I would probably say safety. And then fourth, man, I guess interior D-line.
That's yeah, that's pretty much exactly how I would have ordered it too. I would like to see them draft a quarterback.
A quarterback?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I just don't know, you know, if Tavares Jackson's going to be back. And I mean, no team in the NFL is going to win a Super Bowl. Besides maybe Denver is going to win a Super Bowl without their starting quarterback, right? Like, that's just the nature of it. So, you know, I've had a lot of people respond to articles or tweet at me saying, yeah, well, if Russell Wilson goes down, they're sunk. Well, yeah, that's true about any good team, right? The Packers lose Aaron Rodgers, they're sunk.
For the Broncos, apparently.
Right. You know, like the Broncos are kind of that rare exception. So,
right.
You know, if Russell Wilson, who thank the Lord has never missed a game or a practice, which is really amazing considering the state of his offensive lines, if it ever happens, you know, if he's gone for the season, Seahawks aren't going to win the Super Bowl. Mm-mm. But if he has to miss 4 to 6 games, you need someone that can go in and win at least 50% of those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that Tavares Jackson is that. And I don't know for how much longer he's going to be that. BJ Daniels has moved on. So I would really like to see them come away with a quarterback somehow that they can start grooming behind Russell Wilson and, you know, be prepared where, hey, if you got to go play 5 games without him, that you can go win 3 of them.
Yeah. And where would you like envision them taking someone like that, like 3rd, 4th, 5th?
Yeah. I wouldn't, I mean, what you have to pay quarterbacks is a lot. I wouldn't want to see, you know, top 3 pick going towards a quarterback. And you know, it's one of those things where Seattle has already proven that you don't have to go with a prototype quarterback to have success. So exactly what they're looking for. Do you try and find the closest thing to Russell Wilson that you can and go for a guy like Vernon Adams? Or do you just go for the best value quarterback, someone that you think is really special that can be had in a 5th or 6th round, but maybe is more of a standard pocket passer? I don't know how they value that. I don't know how versatile they see their offense in being able to adjust to a non-Russell Wilson. But I would like to see them come out of the draft with a quarterback at some point.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I wouldn't be disappointed if they spent one of their picks on that guy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like John Schneider, I think, said early on, obviously hasn't said it lately, but said early on, they're going to draft a quarterback every year. And how many have they picked? Oh, one.
Yeah, right. So, I was going to say that off the top of my head, that doesn't seem to have been the case.
No, that was just one guy named Russell Wilson. That's the only quarterback they've drafted. Sort of
eliminated the need. Yeah, right, exactly. Listen, for all of my many varying thoughts on Russell Wilson, the person, Russell Wilson the player, is like one of the greatest things that's ever happened to the city of Seattle, truly. So
right.
he sort of covers a multitude of sins in terms of giving you some margin for error as a franchise. Have a quarterback like him. People have already given us an hour of their time, so I do want to wrap up. But last thing I wanted to ask you, Danny, is there anybody else on the market outside of Penn and Beecham that you're hoping Seattle brings in and you're hoping that they sign?
At any position?
Yeah.
I have just like an unabashed crush on Arian Foster as a player. Like, I just love Arian Foster. He's just so when he's healthy, I mean, obviously that's not the case anymore. Like, he hasn't been healthy for a while, and potentially this is just my bias of watching him kind of in his prime and all that. Obviously, there's all these caveats that go along with it. But I just really like Arian Foster as a player. I think he fit the system perfectly. He's a really entertaining guy. If you have him in kind of like a timeshare or like a, you know, whatever it is with Thomas Rawls, I think that would be good for both of them. I don't know for sure if he would want to do that or if he sees himself still as like a full-time carry the ball 300 times a year kind of guy or whatever. Maybe, you know, the last couple of years have kind of given him some, you know, perspective on kind of where he is in his career. But I don't know. I really like Arian Foster. So I just kind of as like a fanboy would like to see that happen. But I mean, if it wasn't for that, I really want them to go get a pass rusher, like a Chris Long or someone who's like, you know, a little past their prime potentially, but still has like some real skill as a pass rusher. And then bring them in kind of as like a guy who can play like that nickel pass rusher that Bruce Irvin is not going to be there this year. So personally, I think Chris Long would be cool. I think he's still, you know, he's battled injuries the last couple of years. I think he still could have some in the tank and be a good like rotational guy. I don't know how they'd fit him in because he's played kind of, you know, a position that the Seahawks already have with Averill, but I don't know. Maybe I think
tell the offensive line what to expect from the Rams D line that they've never blocked once on a single play in life.
Exactly. Exactly. Is Aaron Donald available? Can I take him?
Yeah, can we just trade? You know what? You can pick a player and I'll pick Aaron Donald.
Yeah, I want him. No, I don't know. So my fanboy pick would be Arian Foster. I doubt that'll happen. And even if it did, I doubt he'd be the same player he used to be. I just love that guy.
I haven't. Have you even heard of him making any visits? I know Forte signed. You know, there's been a couple of big running back contracts, which you don't see a ton of in free agency. But Matt Forte and Doug Martin have signed, I think, bigger deals. Lamar Miller switched spots. C.J. Anderson switched spots. These are kind of second tier running backs.
Chris Ivory.
I haven't heard a whisper on Arian Foster linked to a team yet.
No, I haven't heard anything. And I think that's probably expected. He's coming off an Achilles. He's coming off of two years where he's been injured. I'm guessing he's one of those signings that happens like a couple weeks after the first like big round, you know? Mm-hmm. So teams are still kind of feeling it out and filling their holes through like the first and second maybe level free agency, and then he might kind of be like a third level guy, like an injury flyer.
Well, I'm with you, man. I love him. I think Arian Foster is one of maybe four or five athletes I follow on social media.
Right.
Athletes are just dreadful on social media. But Arian Foster is a super interesting dude. And I'm with you, man. He's one of my very favorite players in the entire NFL. I'd love to see him come in for 100, you know, as kind of 150 touches a year type of guy. I think that him and Thomas Rawls, I mean, that we're talking guys that could account for 2,500 yards from scrimmage between the two of them. So that would be super exciting to see.
He's a really good receiver too.
Exceptional, yeah.
So I mean, he could be like the Fred Jackson style. Fred Jackson? Yep. Yeah, I always get his names. I always call him Fred Taylor.
Oh, yeah, I remember him.
So anyways, Fred Jackson. No, but I mean, I just think I was just Googling or I was searching on Twitter for Arian Foster. Now, it sounds like, according to a couple of different rumors, this is from Mike Florio at PFT, his plan is to be patient, maybe seeing what happens all the way into the draft. So he might not choose and for a while where he's going to play. I don't really know what's going on, but, you know, he's definitely an injury flyer. Like you could get him and he could be like slower than like what Fred Jackson was this year, which is really slow.
It happens quick.
Yeah. But then I'm always just like, man, if he had anything near where he used to be. He's just so savvy in the way he runs. Like he chooses the right lanes. He's like, I don't even know. Like they were talking about, Pete Carroll was talking about this with Marshawn Lynch. It's almost like he's like a mogul skier. I think Carol used that analogy. It's like he has crazy ability to like get through the crease and get into the second level.
It's weird. It's like he teleports 2 yards forward from where he's behind his offensive line to where he's behind the defensive line.
Right. So he's anything but a running back that I think relies on pure speed.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't think he's got the speed that he used to have. And I'm pretty sure he won't. But there's so much more to his game than the speed thing. So that I just think, put him in the system, I think he could be really good. You know, for people that don't know, he's played in the zone blocking scheme his whole career. It's basically the same scheme that Tom Cable uses. It's all based on the Shanahan thing from back in the day, the Gibbs zone blocking scheme. So it's the same stuff. I think it'd be really easy for him to hit the ground running, no pun intended.
That would be a super exciting one. Definitely will be one for us to keep our eyes on. That's not a signing that's going to slip under the radar if it happens. We've been going for a little bit here. I'll let all of you listeners off the hook. Danny, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate that. And we'll be getting back together. We'll be in the studio/the bar here in the next week or so as free agency continues to start to get prepared for the draft. But until then, thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you soon.
All right, see ya.